There, I am John Cryer, and this is the Undisclosed Addendum. On this week's show, we'll be talking about episode 16 of our Dennis Perry series, Hypothetical Firebreaks, which actually I thought would more accurately be titled, Dale Bundy, You Scamp. with us today is Colin Miller. He's an associate dean and professor of law at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he blogs at Evidence Prof Blog, and also Susan Simpson, associate of the Volkov Law Group, and also the host of the 45th. Hey guys, welcome.
Hey.
Hey,
maybe I'll make that the title of the addendum episode.
There we go. I like it. I feel like I contribute as an artist here. But actually, I thought it was a really fascinating look into the minds of the jury, and also deeply terrifying. Because it sounds to me like, and Donna was clearly, I believe it was Donna was her name?
Yeah.
Yeah. She was clearly the exception, but it sounded like the presumption of innocence was pretty much out the window from the beginning on this. Does that sound like a correct assessment?
Presumption of innocence, reasonable doubts are all words we use, but I think it's really a crapshoot if they actually appear in the deliberations, if they have any role in the actual process. We all like say those words and they sound reassuring, but whether they actually manifest themselves, I don't know, always, obviously.
Well, yeah, it seems like so many times the jury was faced with similar facts on both sides that they just decided to ignore on one for some reason.
Yeah, yeah. Reasonable doubt, it's a very high standard. And I don't think that under a traditional notions of it, you could possibly find it here. But this jury did. Although they don't even talk in terms of reasonable doubt. They talk in terms of like, I think he probably did it. They're not even trying to couch their decisions if they thought it was beyond reasonable doubt. They know that's the standard, but you talk to these jurors, that's not the language they're using themselves.
And it was clear that they believed a lot of what Dale Bundy had to say, but for some reason you get a GBI investigator like Joe Gregory on the stand as well, and that they dismiss out of hand.
They do, or they didn't understand it. It's hard to tell because so few actually recalled him. It's hard to really assess now if that was the deliberate move on their part to disregard him or discount it. I think more likely it was because of the lack of documents. They felt like they couldn't consider it that deeply. But now, at least, very few of them actually recalled him.
Of course, some people find it suspicious that Joe Gregory's notes are missing. Were there notes from other investigators?
Not the GBI. What we have is the notes from some of Butch Kennedy's notes. That's the Camden County Sheriff's Department. And we have some of the written, like typewritten reports that Gregory did. But he has he had boxes that are gone. And the box that would have contained, most importantly, probably, well, one, the alibi evidence, his notes about investigating Dennis Perry's alibi. And two, the photo arrays that he showed Vanzola Williams when she looked at the photos, which included Dennis Perry's photo. And she said, no, it's none of them. They're not even close.
But he remembered it clearly, and he did testify.
He did. And Vanzola Williams also testified to that. Obviously, she could not say that Dennis Perry was in the photo she looked at, but she did testify that these arrays had been shown to her. And she had said, no, there's no one in there like the guy.
But that was brought up by the defense. Correct?
Yeah.
Got it. Because she had come into the court saying, this is the guy, you know, I remember it now. And the defense brought up the fact that she hadn't in the past.
And that in her previous testimony at the hearing, that was about a year and a half before, August 2001, she had been very clear that she was not sure if Dennis Perry was the right guy. Of course, keep in mind that she has seen Dennis Perry, first of all, in the photo from Jane Bieber, obviously. But the other time she sees him, the next time she sees him, according to her, she does not recall seeing a photo from Bundy, is when she goes to court and he's the guy in orange. So, of course, she knew who he was. And she says, obviously, I mean, I went to court. He was at the table in orange between his attorneys. So I knew who he was. And she claims that she recognized him as the killer anyways. But obviously him being an orange kind of was a tip off.
Yeah. A little bit of a clue. Yeah. But and also it's been, 15 years at that point? Or no, probably 18 years since the actual murder at that point.
That 16 at that point. Yeah.
You know, I don't know if he looked similar at the time or had a similar haircut or, you know, his appearance was in any way close.
He was older. I mean, the real issue here is that photo. That's the one they're saying resemblances to. I mean, he looks pretty different by the time of trial, I think.
Yeah, and I thought it was awfully telling that jurors found it difficult to believe. They completely believed that somebody would remember a phone call from that long ago, but that they wouldn't remember an alibi from that long ago. I think that was Donna saying, oh, well, no, of course he would remember his alibi because, you know, it was a very traumatic event. It's like, no, it wasn't a traumatic event for him because he may not have been there. He may not have had anything to do with that.
And that wasn't her being that was like a pretty common reaction. That's not like something she got in her head that no one else was doing. This was like a pretty common theme. Like, they hear the alibi evidence and they're like, how is this alibi possibly going to recall like what week it was when this happened? And then they don't hear from Dennis Perry. And they're like, wait, why can't he tell us where he was? And because he can't. And like the concept that he didn't know where he was, they just would not accept. It was absolutely the right call to not have him testify. It just wouldn't have helped anything at all. And the jurors would have heard, I mean, like in all these cases, the jurors are going to hear the defense say like, I don't know what happened. I wasn't there. And they're going to blame you for it.
And it seemed like even Donna, who, you know, clearly was giving him the presumption of innocence and was clearly making an effort. She wasn't in any way a negligent juror or anything like that. You know, even she succumbed to the information fog, you know, which was presented by the prosecution. You know, she couldn't remember exactly why she thought he was a drug addict. She couldn't remember why she got all these impressions. Also, by the way, in her defense, this was a long time ago. The trial was in 2003.
She had a shockingly good memory for what she remembered a lot. Stuff that I hadn't even realized that they should have known about because it was like barely referenced in the trial. Just like very like quick, like indirect references. She remembered still and picked up on it. I'm like, wait, how'd you even know this? I thought that mostly it didn't come in a trial. So she had a great memory, but obviously some stuff is going to fade over time. And she herself brought up what you did, John, about the information fog.
Yeah, it's hard to distinguish between stuff that you don't remember was stuff brought in the opening statement. You don't remember if it was brought in as evidence, you know, especially in longer trials. How long was this trial?
5 days.
Okay, so that's it's manageable. So, and actually, I would love to go over exactly what was the evidence presented against Dennis. Because, okay, we know there was Cora and Vanzola.
Two eyewitness IDs, which of course that's generally strong evidence. But in this case, take Vanzola. Vanzola, one, previously had seen arrays, like real arrays, real proper identification procedure arrays of Dennis and said it wasn't him. She has then seen a single photo lineup and then seen the guy at his arraignment in orange and said that's the guy, or maybe, I don't know, it looks like him, but I'm not sure, at a hearing. And only when we get to trial in 2003 does she say, it looks like him, without adding the part, I can't be sure. I don't know. I'm not sure.
Yes. Well, when you put it that way, but again, seeing an older woman, you know, who has shown up at the trial, I just feel like any effort to make her judgment seem clouded or her memory seem clouded might seem like cruelty to a victim, to a juror, you know, watching that. Same thing with Cora. You know, we know that Cora's testimony was, her deposition at least, was all over the place.
It was really all over the place.
Yeah. But I still think a juror is going to give a victim, you know, somebody who was actually in the room when this horrible thing happened and had to watch their friends get gunned down, you're going to give them an enormous amount of leeway. I can see why jurors would absolutely give that a lot of sway.
Cora, though, I still am not entirely sure how much what happened there, because my sense is less that with Vanzola, there's a sympathy factor for sure. With Cora Fisher, they were all kind of like, they just read this transcript in. So they're not really feeling sympathetic for this person they can't see and just hears words read out. And they say the trial, it's like reading it out like a play. But I don't know what they took away from it, because I have to imagine, like, I just have to imagine that closing arguments, you have the defense up there saying, look, Cora identified Donnie Barentine. But none of them, I hope that happened. And if it did, you'd think it would counteract anything else you said, right?
Yeah. Now, how was Dennis Perry's confession actually presented to the jury? It wasn't presented in transcript form, correct?
There's no recording, yeah.
Oh, okay.
So all we have from, like, documentation is the memo that the GBI agent Ron Rhodes made. He says he took notes during the confession, quote unquote, and then later destroyed the notes and wrote a memo based on that. And that's the document that we have to work on. What we have at trial is the representations by the prosecutor that this is a confession. And then we go into the three officers who are present. Bundy, Mullen is the Florida agent, and then Rhodes, the GBI agent. And you have Mullen and Rhodes who basically just parrot that report. They kind of admit, like, I don't remember that clearly. But here's what my report says, refresh my memory. They're going off that report mostly. There's not much else they add beyond that other than explanations for why they didn't record it. And then you've got Bundy. And Bundy is the one who gives the statement that even would be a confession. Mullen and Rhodes do describe what Dennis said as a confession, but their words, how they describe what he said, isn't a confession. It's just like, would you take it all back if you could? Or like, yeah, who wouldn't? Mm-hmm. And then Bundy's up there and says, like, he walked up to Dennis. He was on the phone when the confession started. So he goes up afterwards and is like, now, Dennis, okay, just relax, okay? And you just told them that you were there that night at the church, didn't you? And he said, okay. And that's it. That's basically the whole evidence for the jury.
Yeah, and who introduced the quote of him saying, I was so high, I don't really remember it? That was Bundy, okay.
But, of course, Bundy, when he's talking to me, like, one, does not recall the confession, says I should ask Mullen and Rhodes because he doesn't know anything about it, really. And then, two, like, he's pretty clear that whatever Dennis said, it was about marijuana, not about, you know, other drugs.
Have you ever wanted your own website? Let me tell you something. One of the ways that I find cases to research and investigate for Undisclosed is I find websites that loved ones and advocates of people who are wrongfully incarcerated set up. You know, websites that tell their story, that do some fundraising, that say, hey, you can write a letter like this. They'll even have like all the files online. But you know what? It's an amazing tool for advocacy, but you can use a website for so many things. You can blog, publish content. You know, I have a blog, Susan has a blog, Colin has a blog. You can blog like us. You can sell products and services of all kind. Showcase your work. Do you have a little business that you run? Do you want to have one? There's just a million things you can do with your own website. And I'm sure a lot of you who've never had one think that it's going to be a little complicated to set it up, but it's not true. Squarespace makes creating and having your own website really easy because Squarespace has beautiful templates that are already created by world-class designers. Seriously, all you got to do is go to Squarespace, look at their like hundreds, I don't even know, maybe thousands of styles. There's so many on there. I mean, a style for everybody, really beautiful templates. It's just click and drag and type in your content. It's so easy. And if you're trying to set up a site that you need e-commerce for, well, Squarespace has powerful e-commerce functionality that lets you sell anything online. You can actually customize the look and feel, the settings of products, so many things, as long as you know how to point and click. Everything's also optimized for mobile right out of the box, so you don't have to like create a different version of the website for people's phones. It's just going to happen automatically. Squarespace also offers a new way to buy domains. You can choose from over 200 extensions. You don't have to be a .com or a .co or a .biz. You could be a .dot so many things, all right? They've got built-in search engine optimization, so when people are looking for whatever it is you're offering, they'll be easy to find it. They've got analytics to help you grow in real time. Here at Undisclosed, we're very, very conscious of our analytics. We want to see where our audience is, when they listen, and what they like. And with Squarespace, there's nothing to patch or upgrade ever. Their hosting is free, it is secure, and they've got 24/7 award-winning customer support. Head to squarespace.com/undisclosed for a free trial. And, you know, you can create your own website. When you're ready to launch, all you gotta do is use the offer code undisclosed and save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Once again, go to squarespace.com/undisclosed for a free trial. Check out all the cool tools there. Build your own website. And when you're ready to launch it, just use the offer code undisclosed and get 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Think it, dream it, make it with Squarespace.
So since heroin isn't mentioned, did you look through the transcript to find out what could possibly have given that impression?
Oh, I mean, it's clear. It's just like the way they describe his drug use. You would assume it. Like, you're definitely not going to assume that, A, this is marijuana, and B, the way they talk makes it sound like, you know, a junkie. The problem here is that the defense attorneys just like don't even object, really. They just let Jane Beaver go off about how she didn't like him dating her daughter because he was a drug addict, and all these people told her he was a drug addict and he was on drugs. And just goes on and on. And like, obviously that's like, well, at times it's hearsay for sure, because mm-hmm. she's saying people told me he's a drug addict, but then you can't just have a witness testifying without a basis that, oh, he was on drugs when she clearly has no personal knowledge of it. Or maybe she would have claimed she did. I don't know.
So that's clearly hearsay. So if a defense attorney doesn't raise any objection to what is clearly hearsay, does that constitute ineffective assistance of counsel?
And that would depend a lot. It would probably have to be a really, really high bar for that to rise to IAC level. I'm sure, though, there's cases out there where you could have it like a really concrete example where it might. I'm not aware of any. But in this case, I mean, it doesn't matter because he can't even appeal it. So
it is a very odd omission for a defense attorney not to fight that kind of specific hearsay. And Bundy apparently mentioned it as well.
He does. He doesn't. For Bundy, it's different because Bundy is talking about what was said during that confession. And that, I mean, it's not, I wouldn't say it's good or proper for it to come in, but it's, that's the kind of statement that can't appropriately come in under hearsay rules.
Yeah. And in addition to that, it's character evidence. So it's inadmissible on those grounds. And as Susan noted, there's a foundational issue in terms of what we would call conditional relevance of what's the basis for her knowledge to claim that he is addicted to drugs or uses drugs. So it's not just one objection. There are several different objections the attorneys could have raised here.
For Bundy, they should have clarified, like gotten to say, like, okay, so what he really said is that he smoked weed and drank back then, so he doesn't really know where he was on any given night 15 years ago. And to clarify that when Bundy is using the word high, what he actually means is, like Dennis said, like there were times back in the 80s he smoked weed, so he does not recall every night of his life.
Yeah, because
otherwise, that is a statement against interest. You can bring that in legally.
Yeah, because to actually refer to somebody as an addict, that's not a medical diagnosis, but it's still, it's saying somebody has a drug dependency, which is a, you know, pretty serious charge.
Yeah.
And there's no evidence of it, that he actually had a drug dependency.
Even if he had been, I would argue that that's, I don't want to like make it sound like, oh, if he had been, well, then it all makes sense and explain everything. No, that's just prejudicial. And it makes the jury leap to conclusions. But even if he was, that wouldn't be evidence he was a murderer.
And so there was also evidence that Dennis supposedly knew the Swains, supposedly. And the evidence, I'm sorry, I'm doing finger quotes. You can't see it, but I'm doing finger quotes. And the evidence that he knew of the firebreaks, but that was never entered into any kind of formal theory of the crime unless it was introduced in the closing statements, which we don't know at this
point. They must have done something in closing because a lot of those jurors took home that lesson pretty well. The whole thing is a farce. I mean, one, the conversations that Jane Beaver had with Dennis Perry should have been disclosed, like the ones that she says are the confession. It wasn't. The prosecutor's like, oh, I just suddenly magically learned about this middle of trial, middle of her testimony. So now I'm going to bring it in.
Yeah, I had a bunch of questions about that, about handling information that, I mean, as a practical matter, I imagine that kind of stuff happens. You know, not everybody is perfectly prepared for trials, you know, and stuff happens and stuff comes up. And, you know, judges have to make that judgment call of like, is this something that we should let in? But I would wonder, and perhaps Colin can answer this, defense attorneys are instructed, you know, the axiom is don't ask a question you don't already know the answer to. But if somebody's introducing a completely new bunch of information in, how do you go about questioning that?
I mean, basically, you ask for a continuance. That would be what would be completely appropriate here when the prosecution is saying, look, we have this new information that we just learned right now, and we're going to have this witness testify about these fire breaks, and that's an important part of our case. You ask for a continuance. So you can research it. You can talk to the witness. You can go to the location. You can see how you're going to address that issue, because otherwise you have sort of what we had in this case where they just don't know how to deal with it because this is the first they're learning of it.
Yeah, my sense is that probably the defense must have thought this was such a nothing that they decided, like, you know what, let's not even worry about it too much. Like, who the hell cares about fire breaks? I think that has to be what their thinking was. And plus, they're afraid of snakes. They can't go check it out. That's actually, like, the reason they give. Which, it's... the problem is, too, remember, we are at trial. We're 18 years after the murder. This is going to be a wrong number, but like roughly speaking, like harvesting pine trees took like 20 years to grow. So there probably would have been a harvesting in that time period. So whatever is the landscape looks like then, it's not going to be what it was like at the time of the murders.
So yeah, a trip to it would have been useless anyway.
I think it actually would have been damaging because in sometime in the 2000s, there was a, we keep calling them fire breaks, but really just imagine a bad road. What we have here is a new road was built in the 2000s that's closer to Dennis's house and does more or less kind of snake its way towards Rising Daughter. And that would be a less stupid way of walking to Rising Daughter. It would not make a lot of sense, but it would not be like totally insane. The one that actually existed back in 1985 would be the dumbest thing to ever do. No one's going to walk like that through these awful roads in the dark and add miles to their journey. But the jury would have seen this newer one, not the older one. So the field trip itself might actually not have been the best idea unless they had the full context for what the roads were like back at the original. And, you know, you mentioned, John, that defense attorneys don't want to ask a question. Well, any attorney does not want to ask a question and an answer to. And at trial, the defense is like clearly confused and they just admit they're breaking the rule. They ask her at one point, I know I shouldn't ask a question I don't know the answer to, Ms. Beaver, but tell me what these firebreaks have got to do with this case.
Wow.
They shouldn't have asked that, though, because she tells them, well, I seldom saw him in a car. So we got to explain how I got there.
As though it's her job to explain that, even. You know, she's not the prosecutor. You know, I can see, again, the thing is that lawyers come into a case, they understand that that information is probably useless. But I think a layperson starts to put it together. A layperson Sherlock Holmes it and says, wait a minute, there was a way for him to escape afterwards through the snake-infested swamp. You know, there's a way for him to not have to be on the road and get spotted. But again, nobody was claiming that he needed to hide at that moment. You know, a guy just walking away from a church at night wouldn't necessarily have aroused any particular suspicion, I don't think.
And remember, no one left. The woman did stay in the church about 20 minutes. He could have easily walked home and like before anyone raised the alarm. So it's not even a problem with her case necessarily that no one saw him. It's just I like what you said. I think the jury kind of Sherlock Holmes'd it, and it just kind of stuck in their head because like they're like, oh my gosh, there's a secret path, and that sort of like a drama appeal to them is the best way I can explain it. When in reality, what we're talking about, the only actual evidence that came in was Jane Beaver's statement that one time, Dennis Perry showed up at her daughter's house and she didn't see him walking up US 17. So she's like, how did you get here? He's like, well, I walked up. I like to walk the fire breaks. What she's talking about is a road. It's a cutoff that sort of cuts off this corner of US 17 and Dover Bluff. And it does, you can walk this road to get to Carol Ann's house. And it's maybe like a little bit quicker, 100 feet or 200 feet or so than the road would be. But it's also a road. It's not a fire break. It's nothing magical. It's a road that you would naturally just walk down. So that's the only evidence. And then she just starts spouting off like, oh, there's fire breaks back there too. So he could have used one of them.
Now, you knowing about the snakes, you still decided to Nancy Drew this fully aware. See, snakes, I have a friend who rescues snakes and I still can't handle it. I cannot handle it.
Snakes aren't so bad. Snakes are scared of you. What scared me and what have already failed, the fire ants, that's what I hate. I have already gotten some serious bites down there. I've got some scars from like one time I stepped right in it. It was awful. So while I'm out there, the snakes I don't care about. The fire ants scare the pants off me.
Well, I remember that this is the land of the murder wolves. I'm going to do a callback to a couple of seasons ago, but that can't fill you with confidence as you're stepping into the swamp.
I would have been so thrilled to see one.
The safety of a murder wolf.
I will say, as a side note, one time we were driving, it was like dusk, it was almost full night, a little bit of light still. This was down just off US 17. And I saw a creature run across the road that I cannot identify. And it's the coolest thing that it was, I mean, it's probably a dog in hindsight, but it did not look like a dog. It looked like something like almost like a large weasel. And I've been trying in vain to find out what it was that night. So I'd have been thrilled to see a murder wolf. I just didn't want to see fire ants.
So, and we have got to get to Dr. Larry. Now, first of all, my first reaction, and this is probably dumb on my part, was, holy, they let a pharmacologist perform an autopsy? You don't have to be a medical doctor to be a pathologist? This is news to me.
Well, in Georgia, this was like the lead guy for the GBI. He testified probably in hundreds of trials, and not just about autopsies. This guy was like an expert in all kinds of things, like all kinds of forensics. Like, you know, in this case, it was gunshot residue. He's also like fires and chemicals that can poison you. I mean, he's kind of a jack of all trades when it comes to forensics.
Is there anything to suggest he's qualified to opine on that stuff?
He's done a bunch of them before. I mean, I guess that's a qualification.
No, you're supposed to read books about that kind of stuff. And you can go to, there's courses you can take and stuff like that, that, you can go to fancy schools sometimes and learn those kind of things. Dr. Larry. I'm going to keep referring to him as Dr. Larry because it sounds like he does prescriptions for medical marijuana. That's.
I want to read one line. One line from his autopsy report that, like, in hindsight, is probably what we call again a clue that something was not right here. But he wrote in the autopsy, a wristwatch is present in the left wrist and a wedding band on the right finger of the left hand. The watch reads approximately 45 minutes later than the correct time. The watch is not running. Someone tell me what that, I like.
He's been wearing it in the Twilight Zone.
I just keep thinking about that and trying to find out what it could possibly mean, and I've got nothing so far.
So, okay. Well, maybe the watch was stuck at, no, that doesn't make any sense. If the watch is not running, then, first of all, it's correct twice a day. We know that. but it's only 40 minutes later than the correct time. What
it's
is
it? It's not running at all. I don't, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Dr. Larry. Just don't get high on your own supply, Dr. Larry. That's all I have to say. No, that's terrible.
If you're a listener to this show, you've heard me talk about Framebridge. Framebridge makes it ridiculously easy and affordable to custom frame your favorite things, from art prints and posters to the photos in your phone. And now, with the holidays fast approaching, Framebridge is the easiest way to send truly one-of-a-kind gifts to everyone on your list. Here's how it works. Just go to framebridge.com and upload your photo, or they'll send you packaging to safely mail in your physical pieces. Next, you can preview your item online in any frame style. Choose your favorite to get free recommendations from their talented designers. The expert team at Framebridge will then custom frame your item and deliver your finished product straight to you or wherever you need it. A completely handmade personalized gift from Framebridge starts at $39, is delivered in days, and all shipping is free. Plus, my listeners will get 15% off their first order at framebridge.com when they use my code undisclosed. Now, I can say I've used Framebridge to have my wife's art framed and to have photos from my iPhone framed and used as gifts last holiday season. Both times the process was easy and the result was beautiful. And now Framebridge can do the same for you. With just a few taps on your phone, Framebridge lets you create one-of-a-kind gift that will win the holiday season and make someone happy for years to come. Go to framebridge.com and use the promo code undisclosed, and you'll save an additional 15% off your first order. Again, that's framebridge.com, promo code undisclosed. Framebridge.com, promo code undisclosed. But John, to your prior question, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of jurisdictions, especially sort of jurisdictions like the one here, that have what are known as coroners as opposed to medical examiners. And these are often elected officials.
Oh, we have coroner too. The coroner also testified.
Yeah. And so, I mean, some coroners have medical degrees and they're legitimate professionals, but there are lots of, there have been reports out there about coroners who don't have any medical background and they're offering opinions on cause of death, time of death, et cetera. And that's something just on lack of resources, where these coroner's offices often lack any real degree of scientific credibility.
And it's just, is it just up to the defense to poke holes in it?
Yeah, pretty much. It's up to them to cross-examine and establish these people lack credentials. But yeah, I mean, you think about it, it's your initial impression would be, oh, this is a coroner, this person is a doctor, they have a medical background. In many cases they do, but there certainly are coroners in a lot of mostly smaller jurisdictions that really don't have any type of background that makes them qualified to offer these opinions.
Yeah, in this case, they had the coroner testify, and he testified pretty much like that. He didn't try and claim knowledge he didn't have, and was not a doctor, not offering doctor's opinions. But this guy comes up, and the defense is like, yeah, we'll stipulate that he's an expert on anything he wants to be an expert on. Good to go.
And he brought in the gunshot residue evidence?
Yeah, such that it was. He just talks about finding stuff like on like Thelma Swain's hands, actually, as if she was holding her hands out when she was shot. It's really hard to tell what significance. I mean, this is something we're hoping to get more to later, but I just don't think he really gave a full picture of what happened. And also his reports, a lot of holes and omissions in it. So we don't even know what really happened in terms of some of the evidence here. Interestingly, after the trial, the prosecutor wrote a letter to him saying, like, thank you for your testimony, rah, rah, rah. And the prosecutor says, oh, and about your question about why I didn't ask you about the struggle you wanted to talk about, I simply forgot. And I don't know what, that's actually why we wanted to talk to him. We wanted to find out what he'd felt about after his testimony, where he felt compelled to talk to the prosecutor and say, hey, wait, why couldn't I say the thing I wanted to say?
That there was some element of the struggle that he felt incriminated Dennis?
I don't know. There's all I know from that letter is there's something that he wanted to talk about. And he's like, wait, why didn't you ask me about that? And the prosecutor says, oh, I simply forgot.
Which does happen, by the way. You know, everybody involved are just human beings and they screw up. And it's just that it's not clear what was the evidence that, if you've already got the coroner on, why do you need Dr. Larry?
Well, he's the medical examiner in this case. He did the autopsy.
Okay. Oh, okay. Got it. But there wasn't any particularly damning piece of evidence about Dennis involved in his autopsy.
Certainly not. There was nothing there. I mean, nothing that could point to Dennis. I mean, it couldn't. There's, yeah.
Yeah. We got a lot of questions about that Cora Fisher actually ID'd Donnie Barentine. First of all, one would assume that the defense attorneys would just go nuts at that. I mean, you know, that they would just go to town. But is it clear that she could even, some parts of her deposition seem to indicate she couldn't tell the difference between white people at all?
I mean, she says herself, like, there's never been a time she's been shown a photo that she didn't identify as a killer. You could show her any white man and she'd be like, yep, that's a killer right there. I can tell. I mean, she says that outright. So it's not even really a surprise. I mean, yeah, she would show her any photo. They'd show her your photo, John, and she probably would be like, yep, that's the killer right there.
The pretty in pink killer right there. I have I was actually probably shooting Pretty in Pink at the moment this murder happened. So I might actually have an alibi. You know, obviously, Detective Bundy had a very specific memory of her that doesn't get borne out by. So supposedly that happened while she was giving the deposition that moment.
That's what he recalls. And Jennifer's theory, which I think might be on something, is that it's possible in closing arguments. This is how the prosecutor characterizes that scene. And it could be after all these years, what Bundy recalls is not what happened in reality when she goes, yep, that's the killer. And instead recalls this closing argument where the prosecutor suggests that Cora like rejected the photo, even though she didn't. I don't think he's lying there. I don't think Bundy was like intentionally lying to me when he told me what happened. I just think that his memory has gotten severely warped somehow.
Now, let's say a prosecutor does introduce some new story like that during closing arguments. That's not evidence, obviously, but a jury doesn't know that. Is a defense attorney allowed to actually object during a closing argument?
Yes, but keep in mind here, the other problem is that this evidence really never hardly came in at all. It did come in and it is there. But when Cora testifies, it's because there's a prosecutor investigator just reading out her testimony. I don't know if they had exhibits they're showing around, but it's very possible that the jury never even really caught on to the fact that she identified Barentine's photo.
Because the transcript was just read out sort of blandly and there was no moment of drama there.
Yeah. But it's, again, this is all just speculation, but I think Jennifer could be right up that and thinking that's where Bundy's memory comes from. Then again, yes. I mean, Colin, if that happened, if they actually mischaracterized that badly, they could object, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So closing arguments have to be based upon the evidence presented at trial and any plausible inferences from that. And so if it's neither of those two, defense can object. It's not really thought well on most of the time.
Yeah, you don't want to do that loosely. We got to do it now kind of thing.
Yeah. So you want to think very carefully before you're making that objection. But absolutely, if it's something where you think it's important and you think it's not supported by the evidence, it's something where the defense would want to make that objection.
But to clarify, I have no idea that actually happened here. That's just total guesswork. So that might not be the situation at all.
Yeah, because the only transcript we have is partial. Now, by the way, why only agree to a partial transcript? I can understand that it might be a little more expensive to include. That's really?
Yeah.
But it's that much? I mean,
it's a few thousand. I mean,
really?
I mean,
obviously that's a meaningful amount of money, you know, as an indigent defendant.
This is a bad, yeah, no, there are bad calls all around. And the money, yeah, it was not a good call. That was the logic. It was a terrible call.
When do a lot of terrible calls add up to ineffective assistance of counsel? They don't
matter,
do they?
He can't claim it.
Yeah. Well, obviously, it doesn't matter in this particular case because he waived his appeal. But there's nothing. I mean, Colin, there's no possible standard for just a ridiculous amount of screw ups. No, but again, I'm mischaracterizing this because you guys have talked about this and it sounds like the defense attorneys were on top of a lot of things.
Some things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's tough because there's two ways you can claim ineffective assistance. One is you point to discrete issues and say this issue or that issue by itself could have changed the outcome. The other is to claim ineffective assistance in the aggregate. And John, that's to your point where it becomes tough because they did some things well in this case. They did some things poorly. And it's a tough argument to make if you could even make the argument in a case. Obviously, legally speaking, that's foreclosed here. But to be able to claim we can add up these five or six different things and then cumulatively it pokes these holes in the case and maybe that changes the outcome. Sometimes it works, but that's a pretty tough legal claim to make.
You can have an attorney falling asleep in the middle of trial and it's not going to work for the aggregate claim. That's why people usually make the claim that the specific issue was like dispositive because you'd have to be like throwing up on yourself and just talking gibberish for that claim to work, really.
Wow. Okay. It's like getting a teacher at a public school fired. You know, it's like there's just, you can go nuts. It's not going to happen. The union is just going to make sure that's not going to happen.
And the tough part is it's the state essentially will flip on a dime when it comes to appeal. So at trial, they're going to say, oh, your claim of an alternate suspect doesn't hold water. It's weak. This only underscores the fact that the evidence of your client's guilt is strong. And then after the conviction, when the defense is claiming ineffective assistance, they'll say, oh, well, your trial counsel presented a great alternate theory of this suspect who committed it. And they
the toughest opponent ever. Right, it was the hardest fought case ever. The best attorneys you've ever encountered.
Yeah, yeah. That's what you would see in a case like this, where they would completely change the way that they're approaching how the defense handled this case.
That was a bombshell of the reveal that Dale Bundy had actually owned the land in question that the firebreak would have possibly traversed, the possible firebreak that may or may not have ever been there or played any part in the crime whatsoever.
You want to know the person, the one person who probably know the firebreaks the best? It's Dale Bundy. That's the guy who would know what firebreaks were back there. And he never even, come on. Like, I don't believe for a second it came from Jane Beaver.
Maybe Dale Bundy is the murderer. I'm just putting this out there. No, I retract that because I don't want to get sued. But when you look at the totality of how he looked at this in terms of how he zeroed in on Dennis, and according to other detectives who were investigating, that there was no question for him of even looking into other suspects. And it really does seem like somebody just dealing with a massive amount of confirmation bias. You know, who just, you know, it was on his land. It was, I mean, by the way, this was actually tried in another county, correct?
Well, Glynn County, yeah.
Yeah, but it was investigated, obviously, by people who knew the area. So it's to a hammer, every problem looks like a nail.
He had an overabundance of confidence, as was said in the episode. What gets me is his testimony about Banzola Williams seeing the photo array and rejecting Dennis. And his testimony about Corp Fisher identifying Barentine. Like, they ask him, like, were you concerned when your eyewitnesses, like, either, like, specifically failed to identify Dennis Perry or identified someone else as the killer? And he's like, no, not concerned. It's not a problem. Not a concern at all. I'm like, you better be lying. If you're not lying right now on the stand, then you're the worst investigator of all time. Because he just expresses as if, like, it's totally normal and not a problem. Like, oh, I always expect my eyewitnesses to identify the alternate suspect as the killer. But I know which ID is real. And he just comes off confident. Like, apparently the jury bought it, that he just was not even remotely bothered by all the evidence pointing the other way.
That doesn't surprise me. You know, again, the assumptions go with the state for jurors generally. I think you see a police officer super confident about the case they've made. A, you assume they've got other evidence that maybe you didn't see, which is really wrong. I mean, it's just, you know. And B, you know, you assume that these are professionals. These are professionals who, you know, this is what they do for a living. And there must be a reason that he's so confident about this particular case.
I think that's why Donna Turner was so different than the rest of the jurors in a lot of ways, because she did not come in with that, I'm going to believe the state bias. That was not what caused her to verdict. She definitely was, she was not taking the state's word for it.
Well, obviously, we're all supposed to do that, but it's...
I think that's why she came up so different from the rest of them, is that she definitely did not have... She did not approach it from an assumption that Bundy would be telling the truth.
And I want to get into the prosecutor, John Johnson. He wasn't the same prosecutor who was involved in all the Donnie Barentine cases, correct? That was a different prosecutor in a different jurisdiction.
Well, same jurisdiction. So what happens is it's called the Brunswick Circuit, which is where you have, like, a few... smaller counties in Georgia will be clumped together and all have their... sort of like prosecutorial offices covered by one office for economy's sake. So it'd be the same jurisdiction. I don't know if he was a prosecutor at that point. I mean, he might, I don't think he's that old. I don't think he was involved at all. He probably hadn't gone to law school at that point. I don't know. So that was a different prosecutor, different DA. John Johnson was not the DA at this time. He was just an assistant. And he had not dealt with Barentine in the initial 85 time period.
But he was very helpful this time around.
He was.
Ladies, the FabFitFun winner box is finally here. I just got mine yesterday. I was so excited to open it up and see all the goodies I'm going to be using over the next couple of weeks. Let me tell you, you got to treat yourself, because the items in this box were just amazing. I got an Ahava deep hydration mask that I'm going to be using later today. I got some yoga bath salts that I will be using later today. I can't wait to soak in them. And last night I started using one of the products. It's called a jade roller. I didn't even know this thing existed. It's amazing. It's a little tool that has on both ends these carved pieces of jade that are nice and cool. So like stone, a bigger size and a smaller size. And after you cleanse your face and moisturize and put on your serums, whatever, you roll these things all over your face in a very specific motion. You can look it up, and it's good for your circulation. It helps your moisturizer and your serum set in. It gives you a glow. And by the way, this is not just like something out of left field. This is connected to like Chinese medicine. So I actually did some research about the benefits of it, and jade as a stone has lots of benefits. So I love this new tool. I woke up this morning, like at 6 a.m., I was jade rolling my face. So look, FabFitFun is a seasonal subscription box delivered 4 times a year with full-size fashion, beauty, home, fitness, wellness products for just $49.99 a box. I'm going to tell you something. Most of the products in that box alone, they cost what the entire box costs, okay? And because these are full-size products. There's no samples or anything. The winter box, the total retail value is around $300. So it's an amazing value. You can discover new brands and products. So sign up today for FabFitFun. FabFitFun boxes make amazing gifts for the holidays. Yes, great, great, great gifts for the holidays. I said ladies in the beginning, but you know, gentlemen, anybody, if you are looking for a unique gift, a gift that keeps on giving year round, a gift that's affordable and fun, then well, get the FabFitFun subscription for them. All you gotta do is go to FabFitFun.com, sign up, and use our code undisclosed and get $10 off your first box. So it's not even $49.99, it is $39.99, all right? Go to FabFitFun.com, sign up today, start getting the box for a life well lived. Don't forget to use the promo code undisclosed to get $10 off your first box. That's over $200, sometimes almost $300 worth of stuff for $39.99. Once again, go to FabFitFun.com and use our code undisclosed to get $10 off your first FabFitFun box today.
And now that kind of a prep, it was an email or a phone call?
It was an email. It was an email that some, I mean, if I had to guess what happened is he's like a lot of people, like just prints out emails sometimes. And like, sometimes they get trashed. Sometimes they get stuck in the file and forgotten there. I think he just left it in the file by accident. So it was there when we looked at it.
Because it was a remarkable moment of transparency.
It was very much unlike the rest of their strategy. I think it just probably got forgotten in there.
But is this kind of preparation normal?
Not so much. Or at least it's not supposed to be.
Not that we're aware of. I mean, yeah, this is crossing an ethical line. This would be improper ethical behavior. It might not be exactly suborning perjury, but it certainly is telling this witness to be less than 100% truthful in a way that helps the state and hurts the defendant. And there is Supreme Court precedent on this. I've actually been researching this for an article I've been writing. There's a case called Alcorta versus Texas that kind of has similar behavior by the prosecutor, and it leads to a new trial for the defendant. You can't obviously tell a witness to make things up, but you also can't tell them to withhold certain information or to have a certain narrative that doesn't align completely with their beliefs. And that's kind of what's going on here. They're not directly suborning perjury, but what they're essentially asking this witness to do in towing the company line, that violates the due process rights of the defendant.
If you say you don't recall it, that'll be helpful. So don't change it. Yeah, it's crossing a very serious line. And keep in mind, of course, John Johnson gave this guy immunity. And in his immunity, he says that John Johnson writes that Donnie Barentine was a witness to the murder. So he does that and then turns around and says, okay, now tell the defense investigator you don't remember ever confessing to it.
Wait. He claims that Donnie Barentine was actually present. How did that get lost?
It was in his, it's in the immunity doc. It's in the document that gave Barentine immunity for the murders to testify at trial. But, you know, that's obviously not the story they're going with.
Wow, this hints at a much darker story. By the way, what was it? Because when you read out exactly what John Johnson said, it sounded to me like, well, first he was saying, it's okay if you want to say what you said on that night. I'm trying to remember exactly how he phrased
it. He said, what he wrote was like, you've told us that you don't remember and could have said it. And then says, you should just say that you can't remember.
Got it. And yes, that does sound like you're definitely crossing an ethical line. But it sounds like their whole, the prosecutor, not necessarily him in particular, but the whole DA's office relationship with Donnie Barentine requires further study.
I will say Barentine's response was way more appropriate than John Johnson's email. Barentine just responds. He's just like, well, I have no problem talking to them if they find me. Like, you know, I'll be out of town these dates, but like, let me know. Like, his email seems like totally fine in like comparison to this letter from John Johnson. Like, okay, first of all, why are you even updating a suspect, alternate suspect, about the status investigation? Why are you telling him who's, so John, what John Johnson does is tell him whose DNA is being checked, which,
wow.
Why does Barentine need to know whose DNA is being checked? And two, why are you correcting a part of Barentine's story that he got wrong? That he apparently, it's a sort of a side issue. I think Barentine just didn't know something that happened back in 85. So he was giving a wrong statement about it. And Barentine's being corrected by John Johnson saying, you should know, here's how the legal stuff actually went down. But why?
Well,
why
it sounds, that? Yeah, it sounds to me like, because a lot of police end up creating relationships with people as informants.
But he's in Florida. He ain't an informant with these guys. This guy's not like left Georgia after he got this whole Tougher County thing happened. He's been in Marianna, Florida for a decade and a half.
Mm-hmm. Well, he could still be an informant. You know, if this is a drug corridor, you know, and that they're so busy interdicting all this money in their drug corridor, you know, it would still make sense to have. I mean, it sounds to me like at some point he did something for the cops, you know, gave them information or something, that they're treating him like he deserves some amount of deference because he's made some deal at some point. I this is all speculation. Who knows? But it would explain.
Can say he did work with the South American cartel. That in the last episode, Bill Smith was talking about getting all his drug money from.
Oh, well, okay, maybe that's where Bill Smith found out. And then he neglected to.
But it is the same cartel, no. Worth noting.
Great. Okay, terrific. And Prosecutor Johnson, or DA Johnson, I mean, what does he go by? District Attorney?
He's no longer District Attorney. He was not at the time of the Dennis Perry's trial, he's not now, but he's still a prosecutor down there. And he recently came into sort of the news because there's a really awful case down in Brunswick from the summer. There was a cop that a few years ago was involved in a shooting of a woman named Caroline Small. He and another officer shot and killed her under circumstances where it's ludicrous, quite frankly. He stayed in the force. This year, he apparently had a breakdown, I guess you'd call it, and he was arrested, and he got in an altercation with other officers, and they're arresting him. And when they go to get bond, they let him out. They let this guy out, the former officer, or he was an officer at the time on leave. And what John Johnson tells the court is that, you know, this is fine, and no one's concerned about their safety. No one's worried about this guy. And he knew people were worried about this guy. They told him they were worried about this guy, that they were afraid of what he'd do. And he tells the court that, no, that's not, like, we want him to have bond. No one thinks he's a safety risk. And then he goes out and kills his wife and another man and himself.
Oh, God. Wow. That's, that is an awful case all around. And, you know, obviously it's difficult to tell what constitutes putting a dangerous person out on the street, because obviously there's people who do awful things like that that nobody ever had any clue about.
But John Johnson was allegedly told, by people came forward and say, no, one officer in particular says, I told him that I was, don't give this guy bond. I'm worried for my safety. I've gotten threatened from this guy's threatened me, I think, or someone close to him threatened me after this.
Gotcha. So he's being currently investigated for this particular case?
No, it's just in the news. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's obviously a high profile case in Brunswick, but.
Finding a great deal on the perfect item for your home or your kids or just for you is exciting and hard to predict. But at Zulia.com, great finds are a daily occurrence. Every day at 6 a.m. Pacific, Zulia announces deals on all new items from boutique brands and big labels like Cuisinart, KitchenAid, and Spanx, all up to 70% off. For example, just last week, I was able to use Zulia to get great deals on pajamas, a new microwave, and a new set of towels. So how do they do it? You purchase what you want, then Zulia places one big order, receives the items, and mails them to you. They save money by not storing things in warehouses, which keeps the prices low and lets them offer deals in everything from apparel for you to interactive and personalized toys for kids to home decor. You can shop for essentials or plan ahead for special occasions. Fresh, curated selections make it easy to find great gifts or throw an awesome party. So see for yourself why over 6.5 million members shop at Zulily.com. This month only, our listeners will get an extra 20% off your first order when you sign up at Zulily.com/undisclosed. Again, that's this month only, an extra 20% off your first order when you sign up at Zulily.com/undisclosed. That's Zulily.com/undisclosed.
So I wanted to get to some social media questions, if you guys are cool with that. We got one from somebody named Leith, who says, the reveal of the final plea deal was an emotional gut punch. So basically, if Dennis was guilty of the crime, he would have walked out a free man because, you know, assumedly he would have just pled guilty. But instead, he's spending his life in prison because he is innocent and maintained it. Such injustice.
I want to push back on that because that is the framing of that. I don't think is correct in any way. As someone who's guilty could turn it down. I mean, no, literally guilt or innocent aside, like you should take that deal.
Yeah.
But if you're someone who believes in the system and believes your innocence will actually protect you, that's why you might not take it. Or if you're someone who's guilty and overconfident, I don't think you can infer anything about guilt or innocence. All you can infer is that the state did not trust its own case.
I don't think Leith was inferring guilt from that. I think they were just...
I wouldn't infer innocence from it either. I just infer the state knew its case was extremely questionable and unlikely to prevail.
Yeah, I think they were just noting the irony, the horrible irony of it, that let's say Dennis had committed the murder. Well, at that point, he'd be out of jail, you know, after what it was 3 years, 3 years and a month at that point. So I think it was just the irony of it that Leith was commenting on. For some reason, I'm defending Leith. Leith, you and I, we go way back.
Well, yeah, I mean, this reminded me of the Pam Lanier case, where it was very similar, where the prosecution made a very favorable plea deal during trial. And yeah, I mean, I agree with Susan in the sense that it doesn't necessarily prove innocence, but I think in both cases it shows that the state recognized that their case was weak. They had issues, but ultimately the jury in both cases found, I think for somewhat similar reasons, that these defendants were guilty based upon these flawed narratives.
Lexi Coro, who asks, are there rules about what prosecutors can say in opening statements?
There are. In reality, what it comes down to is it's up to the defense to object, and that's a really hard call. It's hard in closing, but easier because you know what the evidence is. Mm. In opening, I mean, maybe the prosecutor is going to have that evidence.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there'll be certain situations where you'll know based upon the rules of discovery that if they're going to present this at trial, they had to disclose it before, and if they haven't, then you can plausibly object. But as Susan notes, it's definitely tougher to object in opening versus closing because in many cases, you just don't know what's the prosecution going to produce. And so it's tough to be guessing there and saying, objection, are they going to support this with evidence? You don't know.
And keep in mind, there's also the question of how much the prosecutor himself knows. I have doubts about how well John Johnson even understood his own case because he tells the jury in opening statements that Cora Fisher was shot at. Like, he's actually adopting Cora Fisher's very first statement to the cops where she says this guy shot Thelma, then looked in the church, was looking at her like I'm looking at you, and shoots at her. But there's no bullet found and not a six casing, and definitely that just didn't happen. And he tells the jury that's what her story is, which means he is not paying close attention to his own case.
And again, it's left in the lap of the defense to try and make something of that, to say...
Well, that helps them, yeah. Yeah, they have to actually capitalize on it. And they didn't. They never actually asked Cora about the fact that she claimed she was shot at.
But it could be also a case of similar to, you know, unfortunately we have a president who is not truthful very often, and there's a point at which there's so many inaccuracies that you simply can't pay attention to all the corrections because
definitely true.
It's just an overwhelming, you know, tide of inaccuracy. I love using that word.
But with Cora, I feel like that's if you're going to choose one thing to try and hit her on, you hit her on the fact she claims that she was shot at, because that's how she says she saw this guy. She was looking at him like straight on, and he pulled up a gun and shot at her. And that's why she saw him so well. That undermines her ID in the first place. What they do hit her on is the fact that she says initially that the killer was wearing a bright lime green t-shirt, which no one else remotely reported. And then she's like, he didn't have on a lime green t-shirt. Oh, maybe he did. It was like lime green blue. I don't know. But she also says stuff like she describes at one point what sounds like she's talking about two men chasing one another through the sanctuary, which definitely never happened. But it's so weird and confusing that, yeah, like trying to challenge her on it, like, where do you even go with that?
Yeah, again, I think challenging, you'd have to tread very lightly in that sort of situation. But okay, we got another question from Jason Alexander asks, after listening to so many times in your investigations that records, evidence, case files, or whatever goes missing, I was wondering if there is any oversight or consequences for police forces that lose these items.
No. Very rarely, if at all, are there consequences for losing evidence or failing to preserve it.
Is the assumption just always that it's good faith that, you know, accidents happen and stuff gets lost?
I mean, it does happen too. So it's not even like you, I mean, that does happen. Especially in a case this old, I mean, the officers involved in the case now might not have been on the force when this all happened. So sometimes it can be hard to hold, like, the person responsible, like, retired and died 10 years ago. So that, there's a bit of that too here. The question in this case is when the evidence went missing. Did it go missing back in 85 or did it go missing much more recently? And that's what the prosecutor is trying to portray here, if the evidence went missing years ago.
We also got one from Scott Madison who says, wait a tick. He turned down a time served plea. Have you asked Dennis why he turned that one down? I know it's hard admitting to something you didn't do, but time served and leaving that day?
He wouldn't take any deals. He had a very naive and, he didn't know what he was doing. Like he just didn't understand anything. He didn't know. And he thought that he was going home. He thought that the trial, they thought everyone there, but the jury thought the trial was going really well for the defense. He just didn't know.
Okay. We got this one from
MSC Chuck. Let's go with that one.
Yes. There we go. Love it. Love it. Yes. He says, very good episode, but I thought this week was going to be about the judge. Will that episode still air?
Yes. Good point. I got hopeful about something that I might be able to get. And I rearranged the schedule. We'll see if I actually managed to find it or not. But yeah, next week will be more about the judge that I promised you before last.
Well, I too am looking forward. There's some fascinating alleys to go down with her, I would imagine. Well, thank you guys so much. I think that's all we've got for today. You know, this thing just gets curiouser and curiouser. Do we have any idea how many more episodes we're going to do? Because I just keep getting more and more interested.
I think 4 more.
Oh, okay. Okay. Fantastic. I am looking forward. Well, thank you guys so much once again for taking the time today. And I'm looking forward to talking to you again next week.
Thanks, John. Oh, right, not next week, actually. Worth noting. We're off.
Oh, you're right. We're not. Yes, it's
Thanksgiving.
We're off for Thanksgiving.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with episode 17.
Yes, I will be power eating this week. So
it'll be like downing cans of cranberry sauce.
Yes, exactly. Just straight up. But thanks again, guys. And I will talk to you in 2 weeks then.
See you then.
All right. Take
Bye,
care.
Guys.
There you have it. That's another addendum on the books for you. I want to remind everybody, Undisclosed has a Patreon. If you want those bonus episodes with Susan, Robbie, and Colin, you got to go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod and sign up. Also, if you have any information regarding Dennis Perry's case, call us at 410-205-5563 or email us at undisclosedpod@gmail.com. If you feel like checking out our website, it is undisclosed-podcast.com. There's a list of all the criminal justice-related charities that you can make a donation to there. I've said this over and over because they're such an amazing organization. I am donating all of my fees for this season to the Georgia Innocence Project. You can find them at georgiainnocenceproject.org. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at their handle @undisclosedpod. And send us any questions with the #UDAddendum. Please, we love them. I want to thank my assistant, Andrew Congdon, once again, as well as Hannah McCarthy, who does our audio production, and Patrick Cortez, who composed that haunting addenda theme, and Methil Telhan, our project manager. I hope you all have a wonderful holiday, and looking forward to talking to you all again.